or as a beginner, a good meditation object?
Probably the best meditation object to begin with is the breathing, Anapanasati. It says, for those with strong faith, you can also recite the mantra, Buddho. So that's in conjunction with the in and out breath, Buddho, breathe in, breathe out, Buddho, Buddho. And use it also when you're walking meditation. So as you put your right foot down, Buddho, your left foot, Buddho, or can, if can be Buddho, left, right, Buddho, Buddho, or Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. And practice retaining Buddho as your object, you know, as you're walking, as you're sitting. Or you can also just do the breath if you find Buddho doesn't, you don't have the faith to hold up Buddho. Just use the breath, the feeling, the sensation of the in and out breath. You can alternate. You might begin your meditation actually straight off with the asupa practice. Contemplate this body to see it as unattractive. Contemplate the parts, the internal organs, bones, blood, flesh, to see the unattractiveness. See it as a corpse. See it as the four elements breaking down into earth, water, air, fire. When you've done that for a period of time, your mind will naturally get tired because it requires, you know, effort, mental energy to do that reflection. So then when you're mentally becoming tired, you go back to just the breath to establish mindfulness, calm the mind. Then later on, you may go back and do more asupa, and you do it in a sort of alternating fashion, guided by, you know, you have to become aware of your own state of mind. So if you're doing the asupa, it will use up mental energy. So you're aware once the mental energy, your mental strength starts to slip, you'll end up thinking more, distracted, and so on. So that's the time to use the breath meditation to calm your mind down. Other times, you know, you might try to do the breath meditation, and whatever happens, your mind just won't settle down and be with the breath, so then you might turn to a supa. So you alternate in this way. Parami refer to the spiritual qualities required for enlightenment that we accumulate through our practice. And so the depth of our parami depends on how much we've been accumulating these qualities, not just in this life but in previous lives. So you might have been practicing keeping the 5 or the 8 precepts in previous lives. You have that sila bharami, then this life you start practicing the precepts and it seems quite natural, straightforward to do it because you've been doing it before. You already have that skill and that commitment to the precepts in you, so it's a strength of character. Or you're somebody who's been listening and reflecting on Dhamma for many lifetimes, you have panya bharami. So when in this life you start to reflect on the Dhamma, it's very clear to you and you easily understand Dhamma because you already have bharami, you already have that accumulated bharami, that accumulated spiritual quality of wisdom. Or in a worldly sort of comparison, say you're somebody, you've learned to drive a car very well, you're an experienced driver, then for 10 or 20 years you don't drive at all, you stop driving. But because you were an experienced driver previously, Then one day you have to drive a car, you get in the car, very quickly you can revive your skills and you know what you have to do because you already have that experience stored in you. And so you can just learn to drive very quickly again. That's parami, is like that. It's what we accumulate that stays with us.
So to build up our paramis, we really have to start now. I mean, not say start now, but just continue to build up more and more possible.
Of course, it's the practice that leads to the arising and the building of paramis. So if you start practicing right now, you're already building paramis. So this occasion, at this time, you've come to stay in the monastery, keeping precepts, sleeping little, eating little, putting more time into meditating, listening to Dhamma, you're developing your bharami right now, and this will be a cause for the now and for the future, for your practice to deepen, your understanding and the purification of your heart to deepen.
So is this paramis, sometimes we hear the Buddha is called the 10 paramis, something like that. Is this the same kind of paramis? The Buddha is
the 10 different? The 10 paramis that the Buddha perfected in his previous lives right up until he became a Buddha, exactly the same 10 paramis that we're practicing and developing, but you might say he took them to the highest level. And we talk about actually three levels of bharami. That's what you might call the normal or ordinary level of these 10 paramis. The level of sacrifice, commitment and effort put in is the normal level. And then we have what we call the sort of middle level. It's upabharami, is usually defined by the ability or the willingness to sacrifice physical well-being in the pursuit of perfecting the bharami. So you might even sacrifice limbs or your health or your eyes. Then the highest level, Paramatta Bharami, willing to sacrifice your life for the Dhamma, for enlightenment, for developing these 10 qualities. You even put your life on the line and even sacrifice your life. And as you know, the life stories of the previous life stories of the Buddha, sometimes he even sacrificed his life in the practice. So these are 30 Bharami, in a way, you say 30 levels, because each Bharami at 10 has these three levels, so it makes 30. So the Buddha has perfected these 30 paramis. So it's more than us, it's deeper, it's more profound than us, and that's why a Buddha is a Buddha. He's done it so much for so long, helped so many people in so many ways, perfected his own skills in so many ways, that it's so thorough and complete, and nobody can match that other than a Buddha.
What are your suggestions?
Really, this whole practice, this whole way of training is about perfecting the paramis. You're developing them all and they all develop together. Sometimes it's there even, it's hard to separate them out really, because they come up as you do any aspect of the practice. But you have dana, we offer dana, so you're developing dana bharami, that's one of the 10 bharamis. That's a regular practice, that's something you're doing all the time. Sila bharami, you keep the precepts, so whether you're in the monastery or at home, you're keeping the precepts and that's you're putting your effort into that. Satcha bharami, for instance, that's truthfulness and being true to your resolutions, your goals. So you gave the example, you might decide tonight I'm going to stay up all night meditating and I won't sleep, I won't lie down until tomorrow. But you keep to that resolution with satya, you have an honesty and a truthfulness with yourself. I'm going to complete this task that I've set myself. So you're staying in a monastery, there's many, many opportunities where your bharami can develop. And you just take whatever opportunity arises first. So it might be just putting more effort into your meditation, wirya bharami, keeping the precepts, doing dana, you know, the whole, all of them, the opportunities to develop them is there, and they actually support each other and grow together as well. Contemplating death as a meditation, we can contemplate, you know, the Buddha with all his great paramis qualities. He still ended up dying. He entered parinibbana. Sariputta with his great wisdom, Moggallana with his great psychic powers. These great monks, great teachers, enlightened teachers, all of them had to die. So one reflects, there's no one in this world who can escape death, and brings that reflection into one's own heart and says, well, I will have to die, there's no way I can escape this. And you can use it particularly when you have strong emotions, strong defilements come up, lust, anger, delusion, that seem quite untamable and difficult to work with. You know, death contemplation is a very clear-cut method to cut right through to the Dhamma, to drop things, to drop desire for things, aversion to things, and to practice that regularly, you know, as a way of cutting through the normal moods you fall into of liking, disliking, desire, aversion. This is all what you'd call samatha practice, you know, learning to bring up mindfulness, recollect death as an object, recollect that, sustain mindfulness to the point where you start to experience states of samadhi and calm. With that you get the piti and sukha, lightness of body, lightness of mind. It is a samatha object, maranānusati, recollection of death, but it is very close and very natural, or just one step onwards to turn into vipassana, contemplating obviously impermanence, the impermanence of this body, impermanence of the things of this world. So when the mind is calm, one can turn to contemplate vipassana in this way and just see, you know, there's nothing that we can take with us from this world, there's nothing in this world that lasts. That insight deepens the more you contemplate, and using the death contemplation first of all as a basis for calm, for developing samadhi, but then developing insight from that, that will give rise to the sense of, you know, nibbida, the mind turning away from its normal infatuation with the world, desire for the things of this world and the happiness of the world, turn away towards Dhamma. It has more internal piti and sukha, the joy, the happiness nourishing it. So it can be a vehicle, you know, for developing both samatha and insight right to the level of seeing through defilements, dropping defilements. So contemplating the theme of death, one has different experiences arise. Maybe have the sense of watching people, you know, just people around you in the world, going here, going there about their business, but one is seeing really they're just going towards their death. All the other business they're involved with is not that important because it's so temporary. Really the only certain thing is that they're just going towards their death. And that insight, you know, just sticks in the mind as you go about your own daily business. You can see people coming here, going there, but really they're just heading towards their death, just as you are heading towards your own death. So the mind is constantly going deeper than the normal conventional appearance of reality, of, you know, people and their names and their business and what's you know about them, what you like and dislike in this world. You go through that just to see the ultimate truth, the liberating truth that everything is just impermanent. It's not self, these are all just conditions. You're going beyond, you know, the names of people and their personalities. you see that everybody in the end, you know, this body that people have, it's just made up of the four elements which come together for a period of time as a human being due to the effects of food and nourishment and so on, but then eventually it degenerates over time and they break apart with death. And there's nothing really there of any substance or abiding essence. For myself, one time I had a very strong insight into this when I went to see an autopsy at Sirirajya Hospital in Bangkok. Somebody had died, a man had died, and they brought him in to dissect the corpse. And you could see he had eaten his last meal, hadn't even had time to digest the meal. It was all in the stomach. When they opened the stomach up, all the food was there just as he'd just eaten it. But then he died. That's how it can be, isn't it? You eat a meal, you might not even digest that meal, already you die. Death it's that swift, it doesn't choose its time, it doesn't say, oh, I'm going to wait until you've digested your food or done this or done that. When it comes, and there's no choice in the matter. Having worked on that corpse, eventually they cleaned it up and dressed it up and they put it in the uniform of a policeman, because that man had been previously a policeman, ready for the funeral. But I was contemplating, well, this corpse, this unattractive corpse made up of the four elements, you know, now we go back to putting the policeman uniform on, we go back to sort of creating the personality around this corpse, give it a name, history and personality and a uniform, which is the conventional reality, of course. But you could see that's just a superficial thing that we put onto this body, like a uniform you put onto it. Really though, you're just covering over four elements which are actually unattractive, degenerating, decomposing and going back to their original elements. You know, the sense of it being a man, a policeman with a name and a personal history, that's all just a appearance, the samuti satcha, the appearance of things. So contemplating like this is insight meditation, where you really see the separation between the mind that knows the deeper truth, the ultimate truth, and the appearance of things, the conventional reality, and that separation becomes very, very clear and apparent to the mind. So it's not fooled or deluded by conventional reality at that time. And of course that gives rise to a great sense of letting go, detachment, dispassion, fading away of kilesa, greed, anger and delusion, and in its place pity and sukha arise. So leaving the hospital, you know, with that pity and sukha, it's like the body and mind very light, in a very supple way. You know, going back to my place where I was staying, you know, everyone you just see, oh, they're just really just walking puppets or dolls, because it's just these four elements that are temporarily there as a human, in a human form with a consciousness, sort of steering this human form around. But it's just four elements that are no real different from a doll or a puppet. So both with the pitti and sukha, keeping the mind very detached and calm and peaceful inside, and then the insight arising. You know, that was a very profound experience for me that lasted for many days. This, you might say, is the progress of our wisdom or panya from Suttamaya panya, just, you know, hearing the Dhamma, listening to Dhamma, reading it, through to Jintamaya panya, contemplating it, internalizing it, through to Pavanamaya panya, where the mind actually becomes very still, one-pointed, and is seeing and knowing Dhamma without any hindrances or delusions present. And Pavanamaya panya, you know, that's at the point where you actually abandon defilements. Your mind is purifying itself through the effects of the practice. So it's a matter of regular attention to this meditation object, this theme, and the contemplation of death, over and over again, turning the mind to that theme as a way of both calming the mind, bringing up the factors of samadhi, so vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekakata, and in contemplating from that place of peace, that foundation of peace, contemplating the impermanence of this world, the impermanence of this body. Sometimes I would begin practicing just through anapanasati to calm the mind first and to bring up the factors of samadhi. But then once the mind was peaceful, I would always turn to contemplate to see my very own body as a corpse, to apply the asupa meditations, the corpse contemplations, to this body, always seeing it, how it degenerates, and these four elements start to separate, and they are necessarily subject to degeneration. This body can't stay as a body indefinitely. It decomposes. The four element, it goes back to the four elements, but then the four elements separate. In the end, you're really just left with emptiness. There's no self, no being, no person there. So doing that reflection, developing that insight over and over and over again, little by little, this is a cause for one's view towards this body as self to change. So it's the abandoning of sakkaya ditti, instead of seeing it as a self, bringing up the reflection that this is anicca dukkha anatta, and to practice like that, to get, you might say, fluent in it. So regularly contemplating one's own birth, aging, death, the decomposition of the corpse back to the four elements, back to emptiness. In the end, the sense of emptiness just sticks. The sense of self disappears because of one's been practicing this over and over again and gets quicker and more fluent at it. So it's just something you can just quickly go to this reflection, see the impermanence, the decomposing nature of this body, the degeneration of the body, to the four elements, to emptiness, over and over again, quicker and quicker. So gradually one's view changes, the coarser greed, anger and delusion of this mind fades away as sakkaya ditti fades away. And Lumpur Cha, he actually said sometimes, you know, the contemplation of death can lead to realization of Dhamma. There was a question, in the suttas we don't see the Buddha talking about the bodhisattva path as an ideal or as a way of practice, no discussion of building up barami over many lives to become an enlightened Buddha, even though that's actually what he had done. So why would that be? And Ajahn answered, well, in the Theravada suttas, in Theravada Tripitaka, yes, we just have teachings on suffering and the end of suffering, the path that leads to the end of suffering, very straightforward Dhamma. There's no mention of the Bodhisattva ideal, Bodhisattva path. But in the Mahayana suttas there is, and they do talk about that a lot. So that's where these two aspects of Buddhism, you can find them in the world still, in the difference between Theravada and Mahayana.
The chanting that we were doing the other night, the sharing of merits, mentioned that we share merits with the Lord of Death. Why specifically the Lord of Death and not, you know, a particular Brahma or any other particular deity?
Particularly mention the Lord of Death because he has a heavy responsibility. It's a recognition of that. And Lord of Death has a heavy responsibility trying to help beings, particularly those who die and are headed for an unfortunate rebirth, unfortunate destinations, the lower realms. His main duty is to try and escort them out of those realms or prevent, you know, boost them so they don't get reborn there. And as you can imagine, you know, there's so many beings dying and so many are destined for those realms, it's a big job. So he has a lot of work to do. It's a recognition of that, sharing merits with him, because he's doing an important job.
Does the Lord of Death, can the Lord of Death, does the Lord of Death visit the Akamaloka? Does the Lord of Death visit people here, like either in dreams or in their practice?
It's quite possible in practicing, people who meditate, practice the Dhamma, may have a vision or some dream of this being, yeah.
Is that something to be worried about, or is it something to not so much be worried about, but what does that mean?
It's nothing to be afraid of, it's just normal. Maybe we have relatives ที่ว่าญาติสร้างบารมีหมายถึงสร้างบารมีกับ
รวมกันมาก็ได้เคยเป็นเกี่ยวข้องกัน
กับ
พญาโยม
Maybe our own relatives have made some Bārami practice together with that deity. So we have a dream of that deity and it's the connection between us and our relatives to that deity. So they come in a dream. But there's nothing to be frightened of, it's just showing us, well, we have a connection there. And it's we can still use, still share the merits with the deities and other deities as well. But in that dream, you share, if you wake up, you can share the merits with that deity.
Listening to different teachers sometimes, specifically I'm thinking Lumpu Samedo, he talks about accepting suffering and openness and that availability to suffering being the kalesis. And then I might be listening to a talk by Lumpu Panya, where he says, I might say kalesis are the enemy. So I was wondering if Ajahn might have time to do some thoughts.
He says, well, if he speaks, it'll probably be a third version. You've got the open to the kalesas, open your heart, and then you've got that fight them, kill them. And then he'll say something, that'll be another method. So will that increase the confusion or the problem? The goal of both these styles of practice or ways of explaining the practice is the same. It's to develop clear insight, clear knowledge to see not self, our moods, this body, this mind, everything, it's not self, there's not really a being or anything to attach to see that. But the methods, there's different methods, different approaches people use and at different times and for different characters. So the first method you talked about is really for what we call wisdom developing samadhi. So when you're working with your own karma, you have your own moods and kilesas coming up. It's that approach where you're just watching, not fighting or anything, you're just watching and seeing the impermanence of those mental states, different conditions of mind, emotional states, positive, negative. You could say opening your heart, watching, accepting, but really what you're doing is just seeing them as arising and passing away as a way to gradually bring up detachment from those states through seeing them as impermanent, little by little ones, loosening ones. Attachment to all those mental states to the point where the mind settles down in the peace of samadhi, one-pointedness. That's what you call wisdom developing samadhi. The other method that you're talking about, say Ajahn Panya, is a more straightforward samatha approach where you're seeing your aim is to be, make your mind one-pointed with an object. So everything else is an enemy to that, something to be let go of, abandoned, cut off as quickly as possible, developing firm mindfulness on the object. Anything else that comes up has to be dumped quickly to get to the point where the mind is one-pointed. So that's a more, you might say, a more traditional samatha approach. But in the end, you know, whether you're developing through wisdom, contemplating, bringing the mind to calm, or just the straightforward samatha approach, focusing on an object, making the mind still and quiet with that object. You get to that point, then you're also, you get to that same point, then you're seeing everything as anicca, dukkha, anatta, whether you've developed through the wisdom developing samadhi approach or just a straight samatha developing samadhi approach. Then from that point on, once the mind is calmed down, the contemplation is exactly the same, seeing everything as anicca, dukkha, anatta.
Ajahn, is making Aditana very important, and how does it work, and when should we make that Aditana?
Using Aditana Bharami, it's a method to strengthen all the qualities in your practice, to bring up commitment, bring up more effort, to set yourself a challenge that you're going to rise to and complete, say. So it's important in terms of what you make an Aditana about and when. You know, you have to know yourself, what you're capable of or what you're potentially capable of, so that you don't waste it and maybe set yourself a task, assign yourself something that you can't do. That's not wise. You might end up disappointed. So you have to know your own limits, your strengths, your weaknesses, and see, well, what will help me to develop my strength? What can I do? Maybe just push myself a little bit more. So he gave the example, maybe you might say, tonight I'm going to sit meditation until midnight, and I'm not going to stop, I'm not going to go to bed early, I'm going to stick to my plan. So you make an aditana, a determination, a resolution. I'm going to meditate till midnight tonight before I go to sleep. I won't go to sleep until midnight. But at the same time, you've got to know that you can do it, and that you're not, you know, exhausted or just so find it so difficult that you give up very quickly and then feel bad or guilty that you didn't do what you set out to do. So you have to know your limits, your strengths, your weaknesses, and see what will do to what you can do, you do to improve your practice, where you need, where you can use Aditana just to sort of push yourself, set yourself targets and goals, and then you can use it in that way. It's a very good thing to do. Yes.
Certain things happen when just in daily life, certain circumstances or situations that occur. If there's any sort of linkage in there when you're practicing, is it wise to think about that, if a coincidence is happening, to think about that, or is that just delusion, or is it something that should just be left alone? When is it skillful enough? Pretty bad example, but I was on my way to see Tanajan Dan, and I was chanting the Dhammacakka Sutta, and a car pulled in front of me, and its number plate was Karma.
No need to think very much about these things, coincidences, connections, because he said, we're already thinking far too much anyway. We start adding to it all by thinking, oh, why has this happened? What's that? Where's that? You know, it just makes it even more confusing. Your practice is about letting go of all the sort of confused and distracted thinking we get caught into. So there's no need to give yourself more work.
The same thing to do with dreams, because a lot of people ask about dreams connections, so should we let just let go?
If you have a dream, a vivid dream state, say, just know it, you know, you wake up, you recollect it, that's it, drop it, let it go, don't think about it, analyze it. The more you think about it, the further away from the truth you'll become, the less you'll know about that dream. You'll just be caught into the analysis and the mental states of all that. If you establish mindfulness, maybe there'll be some meaning that arises just through the mind being calm, still, quiet. Maybe immediately or over time you come to say, oh, that dream, yeah, this is what it was talking about, it was what it meant, through mindfulness, not just through thinking and wondering and doubting about it. So that's the habit you have to get into, just establish mindfulness, know your mind in the present moment, keep it still, not caught into mental proliferation. And so even a dream, you just wake up, you know it, what you know, you memorize it, what happened, and then let it go. It may bring you some knowledge, it may not, doesn't matter, just let it go.
Ajahn, I've been contemplating on emptiness, and could sort of understand there was never a Buddha, there is no Dhamma, and no one's really actually practicing here. So there are no beings,
but it's just happening. So we think we are trying to meditate, but it's just happening, and there is no self, no one's here. Is this the correct understanding?
It's a true reflection. This is what we call vimutti, when the mind sees the true nature of reality, so it liberates it from its attachment to samutti, conventional reality. So it's accompanied by freedom from suffering when you see through to vimutti, through the ultimate reality.
Just one more question. Is it because you don't get a complete understanding of this truth that we still have a feeling of a self?
Yeah, that's correct. So you have practice a lot, practice regularly, do it a lot, so then that insight will stick, it will become clear and profound to you, and the sense of self will fade away. Maybe that's enough for this session. So he says time for meditation, so maybe there's no formal meeting, but I encourage you all to do a bit of meditation. The hall should be open. Did you open the hall?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so the hall's open, or at your kutis.